Hello, everyone. Today's podcast episode is going to be featured on both of my podcasts, both the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast and the Optimistic Future podcast. And I'm going to be the one that's interviewing myself today, essentially. I have a little presentation that I put together on healthy habits to raise healthy kids. The reason that I feel that this podcast topic pertains to both podcasts is because having healthy kids is super important because having healthy kids will hopefully increase the likelihood of having healthy adults into the future and might minimize the risk of them developing a complex chronic illness. So hence the application to the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast. And of course, there are some chronic illnesses that affect children as well, such as PANS and PANDAS. And there can be challenges with, say, a diagnostic label of ADHD, or it can be some health challenges if someone's on the autism spectrum, or different factors like that. So there's kind of the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast relevance. And then my other podcast, An Optimistic Future, I think that encouraging good health in our children is something for our children is something that's important for just our communities at large. When our kids are happy and healthy, then it allows the adults that are in charge of those kids, be it their parents or grandparents or guardians or other caregivers, to be able to focus on other things. Like, goodness knows, in the past, some of my kids, I have three boys, sometimes they're like, oh man, like that cold's pretty bad. They've got, they're spiking a fever. Like, it's stressful. And like, just everything else, nothing else matters when your kids are, feeling unwell. And of course, they've always been fine, thankfully. But I think having healthy children and just not needing to worry about the health of our kids, super important. So if we can kind of encourage those healthy habits, keep our kids as healthy as possible, I think that's important on many levels. And I think it has a relevance to the overcoming, or to the Optimistic Future podcast as well. So hopefully, regardless of which podcast you're listening to, you'll have some interest in this topic, and I'll try to share the information that I think is relevant. The reason that I am put this presentation together myself, I'm not really interviewing myself. I normally interview other people, of course, for the podcast. But the reason that I'm doing this talk myself is because I've been, for folks that follow me on the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast, you're probably aware I've been a naturopathic doctor now in practice for about 15 years. So I have a lot of experience working with many, many patients over the years, thousands of patients, but many of those patients have been pediatric patients, and either patients who have just more, shall we say, run-of-the-mill health challenges like eczema or constipation or asthma or things like that, which of course some of those conditions can be quite serious, not downplaying that at all, but in contrast to, say, more severe challenges like, say again, kids with autoimmune inflammatory issues, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, neurodevelopmental issues that are challenges, that type of thing. For folks who are listening to this interview through the Overcoming Chronic Illness, or too many podcasts, through the Optimistic Future podcast, then now you know. I'm a naturopathic doctor. I've been practicing for about 15 years, and that's why I feel I have a good amount of authority to talk on this topic. This episode was inspired by one of my employees, actually. I was asking her about her thoughts about the Optimistic Future podcast, actually, and she was saying, I just would really love to hear an episode about more about like healthy diet options for kids. And so anyways, I started thinking about the episode. It's like, well, I think maybe just talking about kind of healthy habits in general, and then sat down, put together this little PowerPoint, and it bloomed into what it is here. So anyways, that's the background, and that's why it's going to be featured, or that it is now featured. By the time you're listening to this, it's no longer in the future. And be featured for on both podcasts. So without further ado, let's jump into this. So as folks who listen to my Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast episode, or who follow me on social media would know, I put out this disclaimer all the time. I usually don't have to for the Optimistic Future podcast episodes, because we're not talking about health related topics, but just where we are in this case. I will mention here that the content in this podcast episode is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as medical advice. If you need medical advice, please speak to your healthcare provider to provide that advice, or to obtain rather that advice. So a quick rundown about what we'll talk about here, what I'll be discussing here. So dietary considerations, again, inspired by my wonderful employee. The importance, excuse me, the benefits of outside time, minimizing chemical exposure, movement, screen time, and something called attachment parenting. So when I put this presentation together, I was thinking, you know, what are some of the things that I've learned over my time of as being a parent? My oldest is about 2 months shy of being 18 years old. So I've been parenting him for quite a while now. I was thinking about his health when he was gestating in utero as well. So a little over 18 years now of you know, thinking about these types of things. My firstborn was born when I was still in naturopathic school. So even before I started working with pediatric patients, then I've been thinking about these things. So over the course of time, just through continuing education and things that have come across my radar, things that have come across my wife's radar. She's a naturopathic doctor as well. So she kind of looks at things not just through the parental eye, but also through the healthcare provider eye as well. These are some of the things that I think are, I'm the most pleased that I learned about either through my clinical practice and clinical experience or just through other, you know, learning outside of that, and then just seeing, you know, what are the things that seem to have seemed to have been the most impactful or important for my ability to parent as well as I feel like I can, and also for the health of my children and hopefully encouraging their health into the future. Also kind of retroactively looking at some of the things that may have impacted my health or my wife's health or some of my adult patients' health, and then looking and seeing how, oh, it probably would have been a good thing if, you know, our parents knew about these things, which, you know, of course, life is a journey, and, you know, can't know everything out of the gate, certainly. So we just always do the best that we can as parents. And this is this was kind of the mindset that I had around compiling this list. So certainly not an exhaustive list of all the things that I think are important for kids, but these are some of the more ones that I think are, I'm the most excited to talk about. I think some of the most relevant and hopefully covering a lot of ground here. So in terms of dietary considerations, I think that, and again, this is the approach that I take with my children. This is the approach that I will generally counsel the parents of my pediatric patients. We don't always get into the nitty-gritty of dietary considerations, you know, it's not always a hallmark thing. So, but when we do talk about diet, which is in a majority of my pediatric cases, but these are some of the principles that I, you know, we embody in my household, and then also that I generally will emphasize for the majority of my pediatric patients. And a lot of this spills over into adult health as well. But the rules in my mind, at least for kids, are a little bit different because their metabolic needs are different. You know, they're of course growing, you know, rapidly. You know, as adults, we're still growing in that we have to, you know, cellular regeneration, cellular division is still important, whether we're exercising and trying to put on more muscle mass, or we're replacing old cells that have, you know, reached the end of their viable lifespan, and now we have to replace them with new ones after they've been sort of destroyed through apoptosis. At the end of the day, of course, children, compared to us fully grown folks, fully grown humans, they have a much higher energy demand. So, you know, whereas in my experience and in my opinion, a lot of adults, we, unless we're very, very active, you know, we don't really need, like, say, tons of carbohydrates. Whereas for kids, we'll see something coming up here where, you know, I'll say, well, yeah, fruit juice, like, not a terrible thing for kids. Adults probably don't really ever need to drink fruit juice. You know, it's fine to do it. Free country, hopefully, wherever you live is a free country. Folks around the world listen to this, so don't know what's supplying to everybody. But, you know, it's something that we really generally don't need that, like, huge shot of, you know, carbohydrates and calories in the form of juice. Whereas with kids, it's not necessarily the healthiest thing to consume all the time, in my opinion. But if we are going to give our kids juice, it's like, well, okay, have the juice when you're about to burn a bunch of energy. Like, here, drink this juice and now go play outside for 2 hours. Don't drink this juice and then try to sit still in a classroom for 2 hours. I mean, again, whatever parents want to do with their kids, it's challenging. Managing kids is not the easiest thing in the world. There's certainly no finite playbook, but this is where some of the recommendations will kind of differ for adults and for children. But anyways, getting off on a tangent there. So protein, in my opinion, is very important. We need to make sure kids are getting a lot of protein. And really, it's one of the main drivers for growth processes in our cells. It's really important to make all of our enzymes and muscle tissue and bones and et cetera, et cetera. Everything is structured in our bodies, have a protein component to it in terms of structural development and growth. Now, one of the things with kids that we thankfully don't have to really worry about, to my understanding, is that when they're consuming protein, it's okay if they you kind of load the protein in at certain times of the day. So for adults, to my understanding, it's pretty important for us to be getting protein in throughout the day. Now, bearing in mind that some folks, a good option for them is say intermittent fasting. Other people, not so much. They need to eat 3 square meals a day, or some people should be grazers through the day. It really depends on the case. But with adults, we generally want to space our protein out through the day or spread it out through the day because we just can't make full use of it all at once. If I need 100 grams of protein or 60 grams of protein or whatever it is for my daily needs based on my size and activity level, then for me as a fully grown individual, I probably shouldn't eat all of that all at once. I should really try to space it out maybe in 2 or 3 divided doses, so to speak, of protein through the day. For children, to my understanding, it doesn't really matter. Their physiology is such their bodies will just kind of use that protein and really won't waste it, even if it's more front loaded or back loaded in the day. So as much as for my kids, my wife and I strive to get, and succeed, really. We've been at it for a while now, but generally are successful at getting protein into them every meal of the day. If there's a situation where it's like, I just cannot get my kid to eat protein at breakfast time, but, we do pretty well at lunch and he eats tons of meat at dinner, for example, it's like, that's okay. We don't have to worry about it quite as much for the, spacing out for the little humans that are out there. So protein is important, though, and so when my wife and I are structuring meals for our kids, then it's kind of like, okay, let's start with the protein because that's what we feel is the most important. And then we'll add the, fat and carbs thinking about micronutrients and whatnot on top of that. Another, I think important principle, I'm sure this isn't a surprise to anyone, but refined sugar is not healthy. Trying to minimize our intake of refined sugar as a species, I think, is probably a very, very good idea. That's a huge topic, I think the sort of discussion is fairly settled that we're all quite aware that refined sugar is not healthy. So that would be, cane sugar, high fructose corn syrup. If on the label it says glucose, fructose, or sucrose, these are refined sugars. So trying to keep those to a minimum as much as possible, I think, is important. I do have some thoughts that I'll share here in the upcoming slides about, thoughts around what's a good, what are healthy or good options for, say, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, that kind of thing. So we'll see that there are refined sugar-free options there. I think that organic is worth considering, or at the very least trying to consume spray-free foods, if possible, vegetables, if possible. I had a wonderful interview with a woman named Laura Adler. She's a health coach, and she has her handle on Instagram is Environmental Toxins Nerd. I actually posted our interview on both podcast platforms as well, because toxic chemicals apply certainly to our health from a chronic illness perspective, and then also from an environmental health and I think just general human health perspective for the Overcoming or for the Optimistic Future podcast as well. So that was posted in, I don't know, February or March of 2024. So it was a great interview, and she's certainly worth following on social media. And anyways, good chat, and I won't beleaguer the point here. But when it comes to avoiding chemicals, I think that it's something that we should, in my opinion, should try to avoid as best we can. Now, I'm very aware of and sympathetic to the fact that, especially nowadays, where I'm recording this in April of 2024, inflation is a real thing. Groceries are getting more and more expensive, and not everybody can afford to eat organic, and that's okay. We always need to try to do the best we can. If I just can't buy any organically grown produce, that's okay. Obviously, we just make the best choices that we can for ourselves and our families. It is worthwhile to consider looking up what's called the Dirty Dozen list. There's a group called I should have probably put the link in here, but didn't think of it and too busy to go back and start recording this all over again. But I believe it's put out by the Environmental Working Group. I really hope it is. Anyways, you can just punch into a search engine, Dirty Dozen list, and it will have the top 12 fruits and vegetables that are the most sprayed, like the most heavily sprayed. So those are the ones that in our household we try to always get organic options on that list if we can. Or if one can't afford to buy organic options, then just consider maybe minimizing your intake of those most heavily sprayed foods. So it's like, oh, if apples are on the list this year, but pears aren't, okay, well, try buying pears instead of apples. And even if they're sprayed pears, at least there's less pesticide exposure. And then another thing that I certainly look at in my patients, and then also bearing in mind this consideration for my children, is watching out for food sensitivities. And so when it comes to food sensitivities, this is something that in the kind of integrative healthcare world, naturopathic medicine, functional medicine world, you know, we this is like the 101 in that kind of sphere, but in more traditional medicine, conventional, you know, sort of quote unquote mainstream medicine, this isn't really something that's talked about a whole heck of a lot. And so just this idea of food sensitivities, where if people think, oh, if my kid's reacting to a food, it's like, oh yeah, they've got a peanut allergy, or they've got lactose intolerance, or, you know, they ate strawberries and got hives. It's like, well, that's going to be likely more of a food allergy, or maybe a, you know, with lactose intolerance, it's, you know, you just don't make the lactase enzyme, so you can't digest the protein or the sugar, so it gives you diarrhea. A food sensitivity is something that's more, harder, it's much harder to put your finger on it. Not always, but in a number of cases it is. So it's more like, oh, my kid has eczema. Why do they have eczema? Well, you know, we look in the medical textbook, eczema is this idiopathic condition, meaning we don't know what causes it. And yet many kids, in my experience, and certainly in the experience of other clinical practices, you know, they cut out gluten and then the eczema gets better or goes away, or they cut out dairy, the eczema gets better and goes away. They cut out corn, the eczema gets better or goes away. Or the, you know, asthma symptoms get better or go away, or the constipation issues, or the gas and bloating gets better or goes away. So these food sensitivities certainly don't apply to every case, but for a number of conditions like the ones listed on the slide, or if you're just listening to this while you're driving, it says eczema, asthma, ADHD, constipation, etc. There are a number of clinical, a lot of the common or most common health issues that might appear or arise for a child, in my experience, are oftentimes, not in every case, but oftentimes related to or impacted by food sensitivities. So the punchline here is that if a child is, you know, having an issue with eczema, asthma, ADHD, constipation, or other issues, you know, rashes or hives, or you know, acne as they're, you know, getting into their preteens and teen years, maybe other behavioral challenges, it's worthwhile to think, well, maybe there's a food sensitivity component here. Maybe I should talk to someone who knows about these things, could do a workup for that, whether it's, you know, blood testing or a therapeutic trial diet or something like that. One quick little note here, I just always try to make, I think it's important to make note that, you know, ADHD, you know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, for many years was, you know, very highly pathologized. It's like, oh, this is a disease, this is bad. You know, the new way of thinking about that, and in my opinion, the correct way of thinking about it, is that, you know, ADHD fits into this category of something called neurodivergence. So the brain of someone with an ADHD label is different than a, you know, neurotypical non-ADHD brain, but it's not a bad or pathological thing. It's just a different kind of nervous system. So I just want to make sure I emphasize that. I'm listing all these other things, which are pathologies. You know, it's never good to have eczema. It's never good to have asthma. But with ADHD, it's like, well, it's this neurodivergence, which can certainly make it mighty challenging in, you know, a traditional classroom setting and cause other challenges. But that's really that it's kind of the environment's fault. It's not the brain's fault, so to speak. With that being said, there have been a few research studies showing that when food sensitivities are identified and eliminated, then the pathological, or I should say the problematic issues associated with, or that folks with an ADHD, or children in these studies with an ADHD diagnosis experience, are better. So it's like, oh, with ADHD, like, I can hyper-focus on things. I can be more creative. I have all these good things with my brain, but it's harder to focus in class, like on, you know, are more easily distracted by sounds, or I need to get up and move around more. Well, sort of those more challenging features that some individuals, some children with an ADHD label have, can be ameliorated. So it's like, oh, I still have all the benefits of my, you know, special, actually advantageous ADHD brain, but without the pathological or the sort of problematic issues or that can come along with that, so to speak. So you kind of have your cake and eat it too. Special enhanced brain, and it's not interfering with day-to-day life as much. So that's just a little clarification on that. So just a few slides here about things to think about for different meals of the day It's all well and good to say, oh, protein's important and refined sugar is bad and eat organic, but like, well, what kind of things can we feed our kids? So for breakfast, and this, if memory serves, was what my employee was specifically saying, like, ah, like what do I feed my kid for breakfast that doesn't have sugar in it? So there are some good options out there, in my opinion. There are low sugar cereals that are available. Like, for example, my one little one, he loves these organic cornflakes. I personally feel that it's important for my family at least to purchase organic corn, because the non-organic corn is genetically modified, and whether or not a person's concerned about having genetically modified food in their body is one thing, but those genetically modified grains or other substances like soybeans or whatnot that are genetically modified, they are sprayed with Roundup, which contains a chemical called glyphosate. And just looking at the research literature, kind of the emerging literature on that, I'm just not comfortable with feeding my children foods that have glyphosate residue in them. I think it's quite frankly very bad for us, and I have a lot of concerns about it. So I'm just specifically mentioning here organic cornflakes. If a person said, I can't afford to buy those organic cornflakes, like, that's okay. There's other, other grains would be an option. It could be non-organic rice puffs. I mean, with wheat, it is one of those things where preferably it would be organic, because even though wheat's not genetically modified, to my understanding, it's typically sprayed with glyphosate as a desiccating agent to help with its harvesting. So, organic corn, organic wheat are the ones that I think are the most important to pay attention to. But other grains, if it's like, oh, it's non-organic oats rather, oats. I wonder what oats taste like. If it's non-organic oats, I don't think that that's a particular problem, or not as much of a problem necessarily. There wouldn't be glyphosate involved in that, for example. So if a person was to use a low sugar cereal, like, they could sweeten it themselves, or like my little guy, who's pretty picky. He doesn't have like these completely dulled, like weird naturopathic taste, but it's like, oh yeah, we'll just get him like roots out of the ground, and he's happy chewing on those. Like, no, he's pretty picky. Love him to pieces. He's pretty picky. So with him, he has his organic cornflakes. We put unsweetened almond milk on there. We put blueberries on there, and he's just happy as a lark, eating those. But for other kids, especially if they're kind of used to, like, oh, I'm used to eating, regular Cheerios or Fruit Loops or something like that, and it's like, oh, we're gonna try to phase them into something like this. You could always add some sweetener to the milk. So in the past, and for various reasons in certain contexts, we've added like a little bit of pure maple syrup or a little bit of honey. So at least we're getting what I feel are a healthier sweetener in the mix, as opposed to the refined sugar, which also, to my understanding, a lot of sugar cane is also desiccated with glyphosate, with Roundup. So there's that pesticide component there too with standard sugar. There's also at the grocery store or other places, low sugar waffles, breakfast bars, muffins, or pancakes. I have a couple of slides coming up with some recipes that just out of my little, I have some handouts, recipe handouts for my patients. So I just cut and pasted a couple of those. Smoothies can be a good option. Not every kid likes them, but it's a really, if they do like them, it's quite a, I think, tasty way to get good nutrition into a child. And so just a simple recipe would be unsweetened almond milk, a banana for the sweetness, some kind of fruit, so strawberries, blueberries, whatever it is, or actually nut butter. My oldest, I don't make smoothies for him anymore, because he's certainly well equipped to make his own breakfast nowadays. But we would actually add, he loved these peanut butter banana smoothies. Like, they're really, really tasty, kind of like a peanut butter milkshake. Very, very nice. And then you can add protein powder in there as well, so you're getting the protein, there's no refined sugar, and can be a good option. It's nice to have a bit of variety for our kids, I think. So I could, once upon a time when I was in charge of breakfast, my wife is in charge of the kids' breakfast now most of the time, except on the weekends. But anyways, it doesn't matter. When I was driving the boat, it was smoothie, a couple of days a week, and we'd have oatmeal a couple of days a week, and then I'd make them pancakes on the weekend when it was just the one oldest one kicking around. So it's nice to have some options to kind of switch things up. We don't have to feed our kids the same thing every day. And then what about that protein? So yeah, the smoothie protein powder, wonderful. But what about the non-smoothie days? So there could of course be scrambled eggs, fried eggs, whatever. Eggs are a good traditional protein source in Western cultures. I think they're wonderful and delicious, but it doesn't have to be eggs. Parents will sometimes say to me, like, my kid just, doesn't like eggs. And like, what am I going to give? And doesn't want a smoothie every day, or doesn't like smoothies. What am I going to give him for protein in the morning? Well, it's kind of this funny tradition here where it's like, oh, like, so if somebody said, I eat a pork chop for breakfast every morning, it's like, oh, what a weirdo. Or like, oh, I eat ground beef for breakfast every morning. Oh, that's strange. Well, why is it strange? It doesn't really matter. What's so special about breakfast? It's not like our digestive tracts can't consume meat protein early in the morning. So my youngest, my six-year-old, he loves ground beef. He would eat it every meal of the day. We usually feed him eggs in the morning, but, I'd have no problem giving him ground beef for when we've been on vacation. Sometimes that's what he's had for breakfast, and that's fine. So it could be, eggs are a good option. Meat's an option. If your kids like nuts or seeds or, butters of those, trying to be, sensitive and to the, vegan or vegetarians that might be listening, don't have a ton of experience with that, with my patients, but I know my sister who's a vegetarian, she does these organic tofu scrambles. Like, so there's different options that are out there for protein in the morning, just to say complement the muffins or pancakes or what have you. So here's a recipe for almond flour breakfast bars. They're quite delicious, if I do say so myself. For folks who are listening, the timestamp here, it's around 25 minutes and 45 seconds or so into the recording. So I'll and this will of course be on the YouTube channel for both podcasts as well. So I will, so you could screenshot this or pause it or whatnot. But anyways, that's the timestamp for that one. Here's an almond flour muffin recipe. Timestamp is 26 minutes and about 5 seconds. And then here's a recipe for gluten-free pancakes. They're rice flour based, although one could use other flours like a gluten-free flour or wheat flour, whatever you so choose. And the timestamp there is 26 minutes and 20 seconds or so. I have to plug in my computer. It might glitch the recording here. So I'm going to hit pause, and hopefully it won't sound too glitchy when I unpause. All right, and then some thoughts about dietary considerations for lunch. So again, some type of protein, meat, nuts, seeds, beans, lentils, that type of thing. So there could be bread involved, whether it's wheat or gluten-free or low carb, like kind of a keto bread or paleo bread, as it's sometimes called, which would be more almond flour based as a rule, or maybe psyllium husk based. Again, for kids, for the most part, I find that as long as a child's not gluten sensitive, then gluten-free is usually fine. I don't usually find that low carb is overly important for kids, unless they have some really notable digestive issues. But anyways, there are exceptions to that out there. But sometimes a gluten-free bread might have some other food trigger in it. So there could be, say, potato starch in there, or some corn in there, or some, not very often, but some kids have issues with rice. There's rice flour in there as a rule. So sometimes those low carb options, because they're say almond flour based, can be a better options. That's why I included that in there. But again, that's really only if there are food sensitivity issues. Rice crackers, there's corn based tortillas out there, and then say chopped veggies or some other type of veggie. So again, kind of using my own kids as example here. So common lunches for them would be having some type of meat. So whether it's ground beef, or it's chicken that's heated up from the night before, or sometimes we get shaved deli ham from a local farmer, Amy Hill's farm. So Amy was interviewed on my Optimistic Future podcast. I think she was episode number 2, if memory serves. So she has a wonderful, small scale farm at here in Nova Scotia, here in Canada. And anyway, so just a little plug for that episode and her farm. Just wonderful, wonderful pork products that she raises with love and care. And it's a wonderful place to get meat from, and eggs and veggies and things like that. So they'll have some type of meat, and then usually we just kind of they'll have some type of carb. So whether it's, you know, rice crackers, maybe a tortilla thing, it might be heated up rice from the night before, maybe noodles from the night, noodles from the night before, and then some type of veggie. So whether it's, you know, chopped carrots, chopped cucumber, they love squash soup. So sometimes it's squash soup, sometimes it's cooked beets from the night before, sometimes it's sweet potatoes. So those are just some common lunches that they would have. And then for supper, same kind of thing. So, you know, maybe making things a little bit switched up for the carb side of things. So again, for folks who are just listening, again, it says meat, nuts and seeds, beans, lentils. So again, for my kids, it would typically be some type of meat. You know, it might be something a bit fancier, like say pork chops, or we'll have spaghetti, spaghetti sauce, which would have a meat base to it. Of course, there could be vegetarian options in there as well. We just eat a lot of meat and animal products in our house because that seems to work the best for our family. Other sides could be, again, rice again, could be potato, could be sweet potato, maybe organic corn, maybe pasta, whether that's, you know, wheat-based pasta or gluten-free pasta. So some type of carb there. And then again, veggies. And in our household, we typically be more prone to doing, having cooked veggies in the evening. And as it says here on the slide, it could be carrots, beets, squash. We're going to mention squash soup again, things like that. And for snacks, little thought-provoking question here. Just says, you know, what is the culture around snacks or dessert in your home? So like with our kids, they will typically, they'll have a mid-morning snack as a rule, I should say not necessarily as a rule, maybe like 50% of the time, give or take. And I have some snack examples here coming up, but they don't really snack a lot through the day. And I think in large part because they have really balanced meals at each meal of the day. I think that what I've seen in my pediatric patient population, and certainly in my adult population, is that a lot of folks, you know, pediatric or adult, they don't eat enough protein in the morning. Sometimes don't eat any protein in the morning. It's like, oh, or at least not enough. So it's like, oh, I'm gonna have my bowl of, you know, some traditional cereal, maybe with some cow's milk. So yep, you're getting some protein in there with the cow's milk, but not enough by and large. And then of course, you know, a couple hours later, like, oh, I'm hungry, and so there's a snack, and that's fine. There's nothing, I mean, when it comes to snacking, I think especially for kids, it's all good. Kids are just meant to grow, so I don't think we can really go wrong with the snacking. In most cases, there are exceptions to that, but I think that it speaks to the in some cases speaks to the nutrient composition in the meals of the day if snacks are something that are really desperately needed. Again, it's okay if kids are snacking, and, you know, not giving any health advice here or anything like that, but it's just something to think about, where it's like, oh, if there's an observation, like, yeah, you know, we really haven't been getting that much protein in with breakfast. You know, it has just been kind of like more of a carb centric kind of extravaganza. Started eating more protein. Oh, you know, little Bobby doesn't really, you know, seem to need a snack, you know, mid morning, or doesn't seem to be needing to snack as much. That can make a significant difference, I think. So again, not saying that snacks are a problem or snacks are a bad thing. But just the reason I bring this up is because one of the challenges that a lot of parents run into is like, oh, what are some healthy snacks? You know, I only have so much time in the day. I can't be, you know, making my own healthy snacks. A lot of the stuff at the grocery store, there are better and better options out there, but they, you know, oftentimes will have some preservative in there, or maybe one or two ingredients that we're not overly enamored with, or the really healthy, or like the, or the non-chemically laden options are just really, really expensive. Or I know in our household, you know, we certainly, you know, like to be frugal with our groceries as best we can, but also I just think about the packaging. You know, we don't want to be, you know, creating more garbage by, you know, having these individually wrapped snacks and things like that. So I think that if we can optimize our kids' meals, then that might lead to a lower need to emphasize snacks, and then that can kind of help to solve the problem. Like, oh, what do I give my kid for snacks? Well, if they don't really need snacks as much, then that helps to solve the problem, because you're getting more nutrient density in those meals, potentially. I mentioned here about dessert as well, because that can can be another challenge. If you know the culture in the home is that like, oh, there's always some dessert that's sent with a school lunch, or there's always a dessert after supper. I mean, that can get really challenging because yes, there are healthier alternatives in my opinion for desserts, but these are things that are either again going to be very expensive to be buying them pre-made, and even in those healthier options, they're not perfectly healthy. You can find a gluten-free, dairy-free, refined sugar-free ice cream, for example, at the store made of say coconut milk or something like that, sweetened with maybe like agave syrup or something like that. But is it really like the healthiest thing? Maybe not the healthiest thing. Maybe it's a healthier alternative for some people, but maybe still not the healthiest option. So one of the things just to consider is, what is that culture as far as dessert goes? And it can be tricky when there's already a sort of dessert culture in place. Trying to, taking things away is challenging when it's like, oh, we want to take this really good thing away. But maybe looking at sort of a transition period of like, well, maybe let's use, work with some healthier dessert options. I know in our household, my wife and I we joke about it semi-regularly where the kids are like, can we please have, like two, homemade muffins, for dessert. And it's like, okay, fine. You guys have been, it's like, sure, we'll let you do it. Not all the time, but this time. And then we look at the ingredient list and it's like, there's bananas in there, there's almond flour in there, there's, some eggs in there. And then we usually can get away with, around half, if not even less, of like the called for sweetener, which is typically honey or pure maple syrup. And it's like, it's really not an unhealthy thing. So they're getting a healthy dessert, they're really excited about it. And they're not actually getting something that's, objectively bad for them, or unhealthy for them. So phasing into like, healthier options over time could be something to think about. Or maybe kind of modifying that culture around the dessert, where it's like, well, we don't have to have dessert, say, every meal. Maybe it's like, we're going to do this, every other day or something like that. So what are some options for snacks? So there's good old fruit, whether that's, just fresh fruit or frozen fruit or say dried fruit. So fruit's typically a pretty fan favorite. The aforementioned muffins or bars can be an option for snacks. In our households, when we're traveling or just, maybe a couple times a week, the kids will get some extra rice crackers or tortilla chips. And then they could just have more of lunch or dinner. So, favorite thing we'll do is, it's like, oh, they have their, post supper muffin or whatever it happens to be. And then like, I'm still hungry. Like, can I have another muffin? It's like, well, how about you have another serving of, have another quarter serving of your supper. And then let's see if you're still hungry. And then that's, I'm sure any parents listening are like nodding their head, like, yes, yes, that is a litmus test. It's a tried and true litmus test of like, is the child actually hungry? Cause you don't want to deprive your child of food, but of course, once you start eating the sweeter stuff, then it's a lot easier to, the taste buds are like, oh, another muffin sounds great. Another, healthy cookie sounds great. Whereas like, I don't really want more pork chop. Okay, I guess you're not actually hungry. And then drinks. This is another one where not going to be anything earth shattering here, but water is a good option. That's probably the best thing for most of us to be drinking. pure fruit juice, as I think I alluded to earlier, it's something that can certainly be consumed for kids. I don't think it's an unhealthy thing for kids if used sort of in moderation at appropriate times. Just a little note here to be cautious if something's labeled, a fruit drink or fruit punch, or if it says a low sugar on the label. I think reading labels is a really good idea. As a very, very general rule, I think eyebrows should be raised a little bit if you're reading a label and you can't pronounce one of the ingredients, or you don't know what one of the ingredients is. If you don't know what it is or it's unpronounceable, it might not be the healthiest thing. That's not a hard and fast rule, but just kind of a general rule to think of. If it says fruit punch or fruit drink, I mean, there are fruit punches that are 100% pure juice, but it is just kind of a tricky word out there. It's like, oh, it's a fruit punch, fruit drink, or like it's fruit, it's liquid, like, oh, it must be fine. But it might be, if you read the ingredient label, it's like, oh, there's added sugar or other things in there that you don't want to be in there. Fruit drink is typically slang for there's some fruit juice in there and then also a bunch of sugar. And then low sugar, I mean, I remember one time at the grocery store, I saw that there was this low sugar apple juice. I was like, well, that's kind of weird. And so you read the label and it's like, yeah, it's apple juice. And then they add extra water, and then they added some aspartame or sucralose, like some artificial sweetener. So just reading the label, and just so that you can make sure you're making an informed decision about what you're consuming. And then, as it says here, just asking yourself, when do I want to hop up my child on sugar? So as I was saying earlier, it's like, hey, if my kids are going to get juice, if we're giving them some supplements or medication, or if they're fighting off a cold or something like that, we'll put it in juice or applesauce or whatnot. And it's like they're going to get that before they have outside time to go play, because we don't want them bouncing around and creating a ruckus, inside the house when they're all hopped up on sugar. So just, not holding any illusions about like, what is juice? You're basically taking all the fiber and everything out of the fruit and then just giving the pure sugar out of the juice. So, or out of the fruit. So it is, sugar in a bottle, which is, again, not a bad thing for kids, but just something to think about. Timing is everything. And then just a thought, this isn't something that every kid likes, but just as an alternative to pop or soda, getting some carbonated water and then adding some juice to it can be quite tasty as a kind of a special drink for a special drink for special occasions or whatnot. So spent quite a lot of time there talking about the diet side of things. Again, wanted to make my wonderful employee happy. And so hopefully that gave her something to chew on, and hopefully everybody else listening something to chew on as well. No pun intended. So the next topic here is outside time. So I think that in my opinion, kids having time outside is really important. Of course, in most schools, probably all schools, I'd imagine, at least in here in Canada, North America, I'm sure in other parts of the world, there's always an outside time with, recess, unless it's, hurricane outside or something like that. So kids are, of course, getting outside time, when they're going to public school. But are they getting enough time outside? And then also, what are they doing outside? If it's like, oh, they're outside and then they're, reading comic books or playing on their phones or whatever it is that kids are doing, just making sure, I think outside time is so important. And then these are the reasons I think it's important. So just asking the question, well, when my child is outside, are they actually doing things that are allowing them to work on some of these different factors? So one is vision optimization. To my understanding, there's some research, this isn't hard and fast, and I'm certainly not an optometrist or ophthalmologist, but to my understanding, there is some research literature indicating that if kids are doing activities where they're like looking at things that are far off in the distance, so if they're out on a nature walk, like a forest walk or something like that, or they're in like a big grassy field and they're looking at things, their friends who are playing, capture the flag or something, like across the field, like needing to look far away is an important thing, or looking at things that are various distances away. Of course, in a, say, traditional classroom setting, it's like, well, there's a certain distance to the chalkboard or whatever they have in classrooms nowadays. And then distance from, say their eye to the page on the desk in front of them or whatnot. But with a lot of us, kids in a classroom or adults in a cubicle or whatnot, like we're not really putting our eyes to their full potential, and we're also generally looking straight ahead, not really needing to worry about our peripheral vision as much, say inside of a classroom or at work. So outside gives a lot of opportunities to use our eyes to their fullest extent, and to my understanding, there is some correlation with more outside time and using our eyes to their fuller potential outside, and a reduced risk of myopia slash close nearsightedness slash need for glasses. Sunlight is also very important. We need it for vitamin D. We need it for a lot of other things. I had a great interview with a woman named Carrie. Her handle is Carrie B Wellness, for my Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast. I think this was in 2023. I don't remember now. It was a while ago. Anyways, we had a great chat about like the myriad benefits of sunlight, and it's not just about vitamin D. So outside time, important for that, on at least non-overcast days, although we get beneficial UV rays even when the cloud cover is up there. Outside time also facilitates natural movements. So what I mean by that is we were designed, our bodies were designed to go through a wide range of movements, hanging upside down, climbing things, doing somersaults, spinning around, like you see kids out at play and it's like, oh my gosh, there's just little monkeys out there. And so outside time tends to facilitate that more than inside time. I mean, there are folks that are, outside of the box, like my family, we have monkey bars inside of our house, because we want our kids to be able to climb inside as well, but or you know, hang and things like that. But outside, of course, encourages more of that natural movement as well. And then also grounding. I believe that making contact with the earth is important on, I think, a number of levels, but even just from strictly a health perspective, I think having that direct contact with the earth is important. And so whether that's, you know, kids playing outside barefoot, you know, in warmer weather, or if they're, you know, in any weather, really, kids will find a way to make contact with the ground, whether it's, you know, crawling on their, you know, on their hands and knees and putting their hands directly on the ground, or, you know, doing those somersaults, putting their heads on the ground or whatnot. Obviously, being careful for ticks and things like that in the grass, depending on where you live. But that contact with the earth, I think, is really important. Next quick topic here is chemical exposure mitigation. So I mentioned earlier on that episode that was featured on both podcasts with Laura Adler, the environmental toxins nerd. So please feel free to reference that. But the punchline from that interview was that chemicals are bad for us. They're not regulated or controlled in the way you might think they would be. It's like, oh, if the government says it's okay to be in this or that product, it must be okay. They've done lots of safety studies. Unfortunately, nothing could be further from the truth. And there's no malice in there. It's just there were no safeguards put in the first place. A lot of chemicals have been grandfathered in over the course of time. And it's just it's a bit of a mess. Trying to minimize our exposure to chemicals, I think, is really important. Just a couple of tidbits there, but please reference that podcast episode if you want more detail, or follow Laura on Instagram. She has posts stuff all the time. She's great. So trying to minimize or ideally just outright avoid artificially scented products. So that could be hand soap, laundry detergent, fabric softener, deodorants for, you know, older kids, perfume, which could be older kids, or just not wearing perfume or cologne or things like that, or ourselves as their parents, because all of these things contain toxic chemicals that are not good for us. The unscented products are a good option, or potentially things that are scented with, say, like essential oils or whatnot, could be an option that's healthier. Minimizing exposure to plastics is also something to consider. So that would be, in particular, like the biggest no-no is heating up food in plastic, but then even trying to minimize, say, plastic food containers, water bottles, like ideally using metal water bottles, or at the very least getting the water bottles that are BPA-free. And there's other chemicals now that some water bottles will say we're free of, you know, this or that other acronym as well. And then trying to minimize pesticide exposure. So that would be kind of circling back to the organic food if possible, or trying to at least choose like the lowest spray foods possible, and that, you know, avoiding the dirty dozen list as best as one can. And then also minimizing pesticide exposure in, say, your lawn, you know, preferably not using any pesticides at all on one's property for various reasons. My very first episode of the Optimistic Future podcast was an interview about No Mow May, which is basically this campaign that's been kind of going around for years now, saying, like, you know, don't mow your lawn in the month of May, don't do any yard work in the month of May, because it inadvertently destroys the habitat of pollinators that aren't quite ready to come out of hibernation yet. But tied in with that as well would be, you know, trying to minimize pesticide use, because we don't want to, you know, kill those critters that are so important for the survival of us and our planet. You know, we don't want to be, you know, using pesticides to kill the bees and kill the butterflies, etc., because they're obviously really crucial. If you've ever seen the Bee Movie, you know, it's, you know, really not good to kill off bees and other pollinators. And then one of the things that Lara had mentioned during our interview, I just don't really ever think of, because I don't know anyone who wears shoes in their home, but I understand some people do wear shoes in their home. And so when we are wearing shoes in our home, then that's going to bring in the chemicals and toxins and whatnot from outside. So if we're walking on the road where there's, you know, tire rubber and, you know, exhaust and all these different things, you know, we just don't want to be tracking those chemicals throughout our homes. So just ideally taking shoes off when we come into our homes. So a note here about movement. So movement for kids, really important for adults as well. ultimately, any movement is good movement. So, it's like, my kid just likes riding their bike and that's all they do. It's like, you know what? That's great. Heck of a lot better than sitting on a couch and not moving. Or my kid, just likes going for walks. I mean, I don't know many kids who just like going for walks, but if they're out there, like, great. It's good to do that. But ideally, there'd be a variety of movement. As I say here on the slide, think full range of motion. So, thinking like, okay, it's great if kids can jump and climb and tumble and run and bike and swim and as much different movement as possible, I think is really, really good. I think it helps to optimize our lymphatic system flow in our bodies. I think it helps to strengthen our various joints and keep our mobility up. It's obviously good for our cardiovascular systems. Really encourages that growth hormone to be working as well as possible, so kids can reach their sort of physiological, full physiological potential as best they can. So movement is wonderful. And so just kind of, I know as parents, we have so much going on. Many of us are very, very busy. Just maybe taking a moment to think like, well, what kind of movement does my kid do during the day? And it's like, you know what? They don't really ever hang upside down. They don't really ever, climb things, or they don't, really do somersaults or this or that, or, like, oh, yeah, I don't know if my kid really knows how to, throw a ball, overhand well or something like that. Just thinking about some of these movements that if they aren't getting a really, really full palette of movements, just think about, okay, well, what can we sort of work on here? So that's just some food for thought there. So again, any movement is good movement, but just thinking if there might be any sort of a key area that might be not being utilized, then that's something to think about. And then just a little reminder here, this is more getting into my own, I don't want to say personal philosophies. It's not like I made this up, but I don't know how widely accepted this is, but so just a little reminder that little humans are little mammals. That's not controversial. We all know we're mammals and humans are little versions. The kids are little, of course. But just what I'm kind of emphasizing here, or what I'm wanting to bring up there, is that mammals in general, when you look at cute little videos on social media or wherever, little mammals, like oftentimes they're tumbling. They're roughhousing a bit. They're wrestling a little bit. And that's something that I've heard some compelling opinions, which are basically just talking about how if kids don't have sort of access to that sort of more like, I don't quite want to say rough and tumble play, because rough can sort of have a negative connotation to it, but if they don't sort of have access to that sort of like, horsing around sort of play, then it might be something that's actually developmentally detrimental to not have access to that. And again, this is not an area that I specialize in. This is just something that I've incorporated into my own parenting philosophy, just listening to other folks who do know about these things more than I do. And I think it is just something to consider. So there's one family that I knew, and they, really didn't do any kind of, wrestling or whatnot with their little guy. And then that little guy hung out with my boys, who do nothing but wrestle, basically. They do lots of other things, but they love wrestling with each other, with me, their older brother. My two younger ones are 6 and 8, and they've been, as soon as they were big enough to roughhouse, they were doing it. And so this little guy spent some time with my kids, and they had the best time, roughhousing a bit, and then I kind of got in on it. And anyways, after that, like, the parents saw, like, oh my gosh, like, he loves this. Like, he was started asking for it, and they're like, okay, we're going to start doing this. And then now they do it on a regular basis, and he loves it. And who knows, maybe that will have zero impact whatsoever on his life one way or the other. Or maybe it's a really good thing. When we do roughhouse, there are so many, nerve endings that are stimulated. We work on our balance and our proprioception and all these different things. I had a wonderful interview with a woman named Rachel Harrington. Her Instagram handle is Sensational Brain. That's her company. She has a company of the same name. We talked all about something called primitive reflexes and sensory integration issues. It was on both podcast platforms, if I didn't mention that, or both podcasts featured this interview. And when I've been following her for quite a while, and her and others who talk about when kids do have these kind of nervous system processing challenges, the therapy for that is doing different exercises and whatnot, but a lot of them have to do with, just certain movements and being, sort of touched in certain areas, like along, say, the length of the spine, to like kind of stimulate the spinal nerves and whatnot. And it's like, that's all stuff that just happens naturally with, more, quote unquote, rough and tumble play. So I just think about that and say, every other mammal does that. Like all the little baby mammals, the cute little bears and dogs and cats and whatever, they all do it. And I think our kids need to do it too. And then just, again, all very anecdotal here, but my kids and I have been doing jujitsu for quite a while. Jujitsu, if you're not familiar, it's kind of like wrestling combined with judo. It's kind of like it's a grappling sport. And I help to teach some, like I assistant instruct or one of the helpers at the classes sometimes, and I'm always watching my kids even if I'm not helping out with the classes, as I just love watching them in action and all that. And like there's just kids of every shape, size, gender, ethnicity, like it's just such a mix of like every kid of every walk in life you can think of. And like they, not every kid in the world goes to a jiu-jitsu class, but just the fact that like, the kids just really seem to love it. And I think it's, anyways, maybe built into our DNA or something like that, but, just yeah, little plug for, that quote unquote rough and tumble play. question mark here saying says barefoot is best question mark. I think that there's a very strong case to be made that trying to be barefoot as much as we can, or using what they call minimalist shoes, which enable us to kind of have our cake and eat it too, and that we're not barefoot when it's snowy outside, or we're walking on rocks, like sharp rocks or something like that, but these minimalist shoes which allow our feet to kind of try to maintain their normal biomechanics while still wearing a shoe, I think, in my opinion, is best. So either being barefoot if we can, or if not barefoot, using minimalist shoes that still encourage the natural biomechanics of our feet, I think is really important for a lot of reasons. There's a wonderful, brilliant woman named Katie Bowman. She's written many books, one of which is called Whole Body Barefoot. She is on my bucket list to have as a person to be interviewed. Haven't reached out to her yet because I don't know that my podcast is popular enough to warrant a guest of her caliber, but I we'll see. Anyways, a little bit of I'll be a little starstruck because my wife and I have been following her for a long time, and she, her and others, but her book. So she's a PhD in human biomechanics, and her book Whole Body Barefoot really changed. I'll say changed my life, changed my wife's life as well, in that it really. Drew a lot of attention to how important foot biomechanics are, not just for the health of our feet, but I would argue every other joint in the body, especially ankles, knees, hips, low backs. As I say to my patients all the time, how many people do you know above the age of 60, even 50, who, don't have some complaint about one of those joints? And it's like, it's hard to find someone who doesn't have some concern there. And I think a lot of it has to do with biomechanical issues with our feet. So anyways, I kind of mentioned it earlier with the outside time and, getting the grounding, but I think barefoot for our kids is great. And anyways, question mark there, because again, I'm not an expert in human like foot biomechanics, but I think it is just something to have on one's radar. So so Katie Bowman is wonderful resource. There's another group called the Foot Collective, which they have an Instagram page. So if you're interested in learning more about that, those would be places to consider getting started. And then last point here on the slide says optimal daily dose of chair usage. So that's a weird bullet point to have. So what do I mean there? What I mean is that, to my understanding, sitting in chairs is not very good for us. When we sit in chairs, it makes our lower body muscles weaker because we're not engaging them. So if you're not, using it, you're, at least not gaining there and maybe losing it a little bit. And then, to my understanding, it also can impair the flow of our lymphatics, getting fluid from our lower bodies back up to our circulatory system. And that's something that might impair our detoxification function, could potentially, and I don't know for sure, again, this is not an area that I'm an expert in, but I've heard smart people who are experts in these areas talk about it and cite research and whatnot. So I think there's something to it, which is why I'm mentioning it here. But that could, you know, potentially exacerbate things like, you know, varicose veins, and could potentially exacerbate things like, you know, different musculoskeletal disorders from the waist down. Maybe have some negative impact on our overall lymphatic system function, and maybe impact our detoxification and whatnot. So I'm personally very mindful about how much time I spend in a chair. I use a standing desk whenever I'm doing phone consultations or video consultations. You know, my wife and kids and I, we, you know, cut the legs off of our dinner table. We sit on the floor while we eat. We try to sit on the floor as much as we can. And just little personal anecdote, when my oldest, who's again almost 18, when he was little, I just, you know, and I was 18 years younger than I am now, in my early 40s now, I just hated being down on the floor. You know, I love them to pieces, still do, played with them all the time. But I was like, oh man, like just playing on the floor, like let's play at the table. Like it was uncomfortable sitting down there. It was like uncomfortable getting up. And I was a pretty fit guy, you know, playing ultimate frisbee and lifting weights and all these things. I wasn't, you know, like an unhealthy individual. But then once we started sitting on the floor all the time, which we probably started doing maybe 10 years ago now, you know, there was a transition period of maybe a couple of months where like, oh, this is kind of uncomfortable. And then now it's like no problem at all. Like my core muscles are stronger, my quad muscles are stronger, just getting used to getting up and down off the floor. So just thinking about chair usage. So how does this translate into kids? Well, of course, in, you know, a traditional classroom setting, they're sitting in a chair. So just thinking about like, oh, if we're gonna do, you know, say we're gonna play a board game, you know, in the evening, well, maybe play that board game on the floor, which is maybe good for the kids, good for the adults as well, to practice some non-chair time as well. So that's what I'm referring to there. Ran to the bend here, a couple more topics. So topic of screen time. So the first bullet point says yikes, because anyone who's got kids that are probably, you know, at least, you know, anywhere between say 8 to 18 years old, it's like, oh my gosh, screen time is quite the thing, whether it's, you know, TV time, phone time, having a phone, because all the other kids have a phone at school. Like it's quite the thing. So I have no wonderful wisdom here. And I'm like, oh, this is the solution to screen time. But I just wanted to include this here and a couple of thoughts. So as it says here, probably best to keep this to a minimum. And I say that because, oops, that easy. Okay, I think we're good. Tried to remove my last bullet point, but I had to just go back because I wasn't quite ready for this current one, but it made a weird sound. I'm just gonna not push any more buttons so I don't ruin this recording somehow. The reason I think it's probably best to keep screen time to a minimum, especially when it comes to, you know, social media interaction with kids, is I've heard some compelling information from, again, experts in this area. Actually, this is a topic that I'm looking in the process of finding someone to interview for the Optimistic Future podcast on, actually, just to get, you know, to flesh out my knowledge around this. I want to talk to an actual expert in this, but to my understanding, there's some compelling evidence to suggest that kids spending, you know, more times on screens, especially, you know, social media, it can be just really bad for their mental health, their attention spans, that kind of thing. So I think it's probably best to keep it to a minimum. But if screens are going to be used, I think, you know, as it says here, trying to minimize social media use for as long as possible is probably best. I know that can be very, very challenging, but just wanted to put it on the slide so it's at least on folks' radars. But I have no magical ideas as to how to make that easy and not turn it into a big fight. Then the other thing here, just maybe food for thought, is that if kids are going to be, say, having screen time, you know, playing video games, in my opinion, I think that, you know, creative and or cooperative games are probably best. Like I'm sure any parents listening here have probably heard of the juggernaut that is the game Minecraft. It's been around for many years. One of my kids just did a little presentation on it. Apparently it was sold several years ago to, I think, maybe Microsoft for like, you know, $2.5 billion. Like just it's just insane how popular this game is. But you know, looking at, you know, would I rather that my kid was playing, say, you know, Call of Duty or some other shooting game versus Minecraft? Like definitely Minecraft, because they can play with their friends, build things together. I mean, there is, you know, it can be a fighting aspect with Minecraft, with, you know, swords and bows and arrows and things. But you know, they're building things, you know, they're being quite creative. There's different cooperative games. So I don't think screen time and video games are, you know, the end of the world. But yeah, just it's a challenging topic, but just something to have on our radars. And the very last topic here is something called attachment parenting. I kind of debated whether or not to put this in the presentation because, as I keep on saying, like, I'm not an expert in this, I'm not an expert in that, and I am an expert in some things, but not in attachment parenting. But I decided to put this in here again just for information's sake. Because this is something that, again, my wife and I, we started using this method with our kids, probably around 10 years ago. And it's something that I think has been really, really good for our family. It works really well for my wife and I, works really well with our philosophy, and just where we have had the chance to, you know, now having done attachment parenting with our oldest for the last 10 years, so since he was about eight, now just about 18, it's proven to be really a really good fit for us. I'm very thankful every day, thankful that I have a really good relationship with my oldest. Did this through his, through the teenage years. Did this through the preteen years, the teenage years. Now just on the verge of being, at least in the eyes of the law, a legal adult. It's something that's been a really good fit, and I'm really thankful that we kind of follow this approach because, when there have been, various challenges, as anyone listening who has or has had teenagers will know, goodness gracious, there can be challenges there, sort of adhering to these principles has been, or sorry, that sounds more dogmatic than I meant it. I'm sort of having some of these kind of guiding principles to, when my wife and I have been making decisions or have made decisions for our kids, it's been really, really helpful. So I just mentioned here at the top of the slide that, this podcast episode is sponsored by Instagram because I'm giving everybody's Instagram handles, but that's where a lot of people, you can find their information. So there's this woman, her name's Ellie. Oh my gosh, I can't remember her last. I think it might be Ellie Hartman. Shoot, I can't remember now. Anyways, her handle is The Attachment Nerd because she is an attachment parenting expert. I think she's a psychologist or something like that. Her handle is The Attachment Nerd because she nerds out on attachment parenting. It's a really, really great resource. She has, she's one of these Instagram accounts where every single post of hers I read, I'm like, I just want to, post this to my, to my story, I think is the right jargon there. So I just want everybody to know about The Attachment Nerd because I think her parenting advice is so, so, so useful. So anyway, she's a really great resource. There's others out there as well. As far as the attachment parenting goes, and again, I'm not an attachment parenting expert, certainly not giving any parenting advice, just speaking to what's been helpful in my family. And some of the things I have listed here with the top priorities, I don't know if these all officially fit under the umbrella of attachment parenting, but I'm just including them here again, because I just wanted to share my thoughts on this. So the top priorities around attachment parenting or analogous philosophy, shall we say, is that kids should have as much access to their parents as possible. Now, that's going to vary from household to household. You're listening to this, you're a single parent, working three jobs and you don't really get much face time with your kids, that's a very different situation than, in my household where my wife is home with the kids, homeschooling them, and I work for myself and I can alter my hours and, book extra days off here and there to spend more time with my kids, and I'm always home for supper and this and that. So, there's a spectrum there, of course. So that's why I say, as much access as possible, or maybe I should have said as much access as reasonably possible. But one of the principles of attachment parenting, to my understanding, is, again, the kids have access. Whether they're going to capitalize on that access is a question mark. And I can say where I've, had raised a child now up until almost 18, the amount of access that the kids want really varies a lot from day to day. So where, my little sweet little 6 year old and 8 year old, they would just spend all day every day with me if given the opportunity. But I just kind of say that, okay, I could revise that. We really capitalize on our time together, but say on, if I'm home on vacation or something like that, and we have, a whole week together, oh, dad time. But then they'll, after say we're hung up for the morning, it's like, okay, kids, I'm going to whatever, work on this. Do you guys want some alone, some of your own free time for play? It's like, they're like, yeah, for sure. And then they'll go play, Lego for an hour or something like that. And then they're ready for more dad time. Whereas, my now 18 year old, there's we'll spend time together, and every once in a while, you know, we'll just start chatting, and it's like, oh my gosh, like this kid's been talking to me for the last 2 hours, and I'm just soaking it all up. Because again, anyone who has a child in that range, or who had a child in that range and is now older, it's like, yeah, you cherish that time when they're in their older teens, because they usually don't want that much time with you. But it's like this attachment parenting philosophy, I'm still, you know, still using that with the oldest one, because it's like, okay, if you know, unless I have to run to work or something, you know, it's like, okay, if he wants to talk to me until, you know, 11 o'clock at night, because he's got stuff on his mind, I'm there for him. Or if he, you know, wants to talk for 10 minutes, it's like, okay, he's going to be the top priority. If I'm like, okay, the kids are Skyping with my mom who lives in Ontario, and she's reading to them over Skype. Okay, wonderful. I've got my like hour and a half on Sunday afternoon to, you know, actually get caught up on some stuff, get caught up on some emails. And then if my oldest, you know, comes into the room and he's like, oh dad, like I want to pick your brain about, you know, he's doing a carpentry apprenticeship, so he wants to talk to me about that, and, or some logistical thing, or his taxes or something, it's like, yep, I'm just there. You know, it's like, that's it's just like this default mode in my mind where it's like, okay, if it's within my power, nobody's going to be, you know, killed or maimed, I'm going to, you know, just kids are, I'm going to give them the attention that they need, you know, when they need it, sort of thing. So anyways, again, going to be different for different family situations, et cetera, but just again, kind of having it like, as I phrased it earlier, kind of like a bit of a guiding principle of like, okay, my kids need access to me. I'm going to, within reason, like, you know, give them the access to me, or they're going to have as much access to me as possible in terms of what they need. And then when they have that access, to my understanding, you know, again, listening to the Attachment Nerd and others, then like, there's just this balance. I think there's this fear, and I think I believe it's unfounded. I mean, I understand where it's coming from, but I believe that it's unfounded. And I'm, again, not a, I'm not an expert in this area, so I could be certainly wrong with this, but I've kind of heard the fear before, this concern before, of like, well, if I give my kid, you know, like too much access to me, then they're just going to want more and more. And like, I gotta live my life too. I gotta do this and that. I need, you know, some time to myself or whatever. What I can say from experience is that the amount of attention or access that kids want, it does really vary quite a bit. And I think that if we give kids the access that they are, if kids have access when they want it, then there's going to sort of be this balance where, again, there's some days where my two youngest, like they're just happy to go play and they're doing their thing. And my wife and I are like, really? Like we just get to kind of hang out, or one of us isn't on kid duty. Like this is amazing. And then other days where they want us all the time. So I think that the concern that like, oh, my kid has too much access to me, they won't learn how to, you know, not need access to me. I believe that, to my understanding, that's not a well-founded concern. And it's something that if we give kids access when they need it and want it, then they're going to figure out how to regulate how much access they actually need to us. And to my understanding, that helps with self-esteem and developing in other relationships, you know, might help to minimize the risk of, you know, becoming overly dependent on another person. Or anyways, again, this is not my area of expertise, but check out the Attachment Nerd and see what you think, or some analogous expert in this. But anyways, that's one of the top priorities. Another top priority here is something called referred to as natural consequences versus punishing kids. So what that basically means is that, okay, say a child, I don't know, keeps you know, leaving their bike up front, you know, they keep forgetting to put their bike away, and like, you got to put your bike away, like we don't want it to get stolen or whatnot. And so they just keep forgetting their bike up front, keep forgetting it up front. Well, you know, you could, as a parent, like we could just straight up punish them and say like, well, you know, okay, you don't get as much screen time, you have to go to bed early, like whatever it is. Like it could be, you know, more of like a arbitrary, like, you know, punitive course of action. Or it could be like, okay, you know, you keep forgetting your bike up front, we're really worried it's going to get stolen. What we're going to do is we're actually going to take your bike away for, you know, 2 days. And then you're going to see what it feels like for it to be stolen, because this is what we're worried about. And if it gets stolen, you know, we don't have the money to buy another one right away, or we don't want you to have to spend all of your, you know, savings, you know, on a new bike. So let's, you know, we're going to put this away for a couple of days and then see, and then you can see what that's like. And then let's see if you can take better care of your bike, because then you'll know what it'd be like to have it stolen. And then, you know, kind of see how that goes. And maybe the kid, you know, does well for a couple of weeks, and then they forget it outside again. And like, okay, you know, you left it outside again, we're going to take it away for, 3 days, and then let's see how it goes. So just where, one could, devil's advocate, is like, well, you're still punishing them. It's like, yeah, it's, a natural consequence, still isn't any fun. I mean, our oldest, when, we again incorporated this 10 years ago, he's like, you're still punishing me. And it's like, no, I understand you don't like this, but like, this is a natural consequence. Like this is, it's an important difference. It's not just semantics. But what we found, like my wife and I have found, is that that was a much more effective approach to take than, just kind of a more like, okay, you're getting a timeout. It's like, you're just sitting in a corner. You can still certainly use timeouts. This doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing, but just thinking about the natural consequence approach, something that's been quite successful for us. We've been really happy with it in our house. Another component of attachment parenting, to my understanding, is kind of this guide, again, kind of guiding principle, is preserve the relationship as a top priority. So this is something that I think applies at all ages, but I think there's a greater, a more obvious application, like as kids are getting older. So like an example around that would be, so if as parents, we say to our kids, you know what, like you can tell me anything, if you have a problem, like, let me know, what's happening. And, like I'm here for you. You can tell me anything. You can always come to me with anything. And then if the child, comes forward and, says, okay, I started smoking, or I stole $50 from somebody, or I don't know, they come forward to you with something, that's really tough as a parent. Cause on the one hand you're like, okay, I'm really glad they came to me and told me about this, but then that's also not okay. And like, depending on the circumstance, like our knee jerk reaction is like, you must be punished. This is terrible. I taught you better than this. And so with attachment parenting, again, I'm not saying any of this is easy. And I'm, again, not an attachment parenting coach, but to my understanding, like an approach in that, using an attachment parenting approach would be, okay, top priority is preserving the relationship. I'm really glad you told me about this. As I said before, I've told you many times, you can come to me with anything. Let's figure this out. Like why are you smoking? Like, why did you take the money? Like this and that. Because if the next step is like, I'm glad you told me, but like now you're grounded for the next month, it's kind of like, ah, geez, like that's, the message to the kid is going to like, ah, maybe I can't tell mom or dad or caregiver about everything, because then I'm going to get grounded for a month. So it is a tricky thing to balance. And, devil's advocate to that would be like, well, yeah, if you're not going to punish them, they're just going to do it again. And again, it's a tricky balance, but again, where we need to make our choices as parents, what type of approach are we going to take? What type of approach are we going to use? Again, the attachment parenting has just been, hands down the best approach for our family. And again, looking at resources, like say from the Attachment Nerd or others, kind of getting a bit of, or there's, attachment parenting coaches out there, psychologists like Ellie from the Attachment Nerd, offering these different services. It's not something that we just have to like, oh, read like an inspirational Instagram post and then just, kind of like figure it out, yourself from there. There are additional resources there, eBooks, this type of thing. But that's just an example of another, I think, to my understanding, core principle of attachment parenting. Very last thing here is to, as it says here, work on your own quote unquote stuff so your kids don't have to. This is a tricky one. This can, stir up a lot of things, and this also doesn't have to be an all or nothing overnight change that has to be made. But what I can say from personal experience is that there were a number of times, this is something that comes up with younger kids as well as, say, preteens and teens and older teens. Things that will, make a parent mad or get really upset or really trigger them about something their kid's doing, again, speaking from personal experience and then also just seeing things by proxy, reflecting on my own childhood, looking at examples on, Instagram posts from the Attachment Nerd and others, in many cases, the things that really trigger us the most about our kids have a lot to do with, how we were raised or baggage that we have, or, preconceived notions about things that, maybe related to that topic, for example. And basically by kind of working on ourselves, by, kind of processing or, integrating some of the, traumas from our childhood, or challenging factors from our childhood, or other stages of life or whatnot, kind of basically, as it says here, working on our own stuff, by doing that, then if I'm paraphrasing here, but my take-home message from, I believe, some attachment nerd content and maybe from some others is that if we work on our own stuff, then our kids don't have to do it for us. And that can be like a really, really tough thing to hear and a tough big pill to swallow. But as I've been looking at attachment parenting for quite a while, reading about this, doing this ourselves, my wife and I in the trenches, so many times it comes down to like, oh darn, I think that's actually true. And as much as it's easier to be like, ah, my kid just needs to stop doing this, they need to stop driving me nuts, I need to punish them, this and that, it's like in a lot of cases it's like, ah, okay, maybe 20% of it is like my kid's just being a rapscallion and maybe needs to be punished, but a lot of it is like, ah, this is actually kind of a big reflection of what's going on in me, a transgenerational thing, within a person's family, anyways, it's I'll leave it there because again, not my area of expertise, but this is just another component of attachment parenting. So if you're listening to this content from this slide, which I see here has been going on for about 16 minutes here, then I think looking into attachment parenting further, if it's something you're not already familiar with, is something worth looking at. Again, I just can't say enough good things about it. And I'm a very open-minded individual. I'm constantly learning new things for my clinical practice, and my wife and I are, always learning new things, looking into new things, seeing parenting advice stuff coming up and whatnot. And if there's a better system that comes up, we will happily jump ship. But I just haven't seen anything better. There's been nothing that's a better fit than the attachment parenting model for our family. So that is why I have this slide here. Yes, and there are other things. So there's an et cetera there as well. This is not everything that attachment parenting embodies, but to my take-home message is these are the main things. All right, last slide. We're all done. I hope that this podcast episode was of interest. I hope that if you made it this far, you gained something from listening to all of this. Again, I think raising our kids, it's our greatest responsibility as parents, greatest joy as parents, we want to do everything that we can for our kids. So these are some of the I think the most important things that I can think of that's been helpful for me raising my kids. So if you are listening to this, or if you're watching this on YouTube, please consider leaving a comment if you have any sort of feedback on this podcast episode, or if there's something that you found to be really helpful in terms of raising your own kids, or some other resource like, oh yeah, like, I don't know the attachment nerd, but this other person is really, really great. Like, please feel free to leave a comment in the comment section, or if you're seeing an Instagram post or something on this, like a little clip or whatnot, please leave in the comment section there. So I'd be curious to hear feedback on this, and then just as it says on the slide here, my podcasts are an Optimistic Future podcast and the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast, and then just a few websites here. So I do run I have an employee who runs a couple of websites for me, madelocalgroup.com and madelocalgroup.ca. Those are both not-for-profit websites. They're actually affiliated with a registered charity here in Canada called the Made Local Group Charity. And we're raising money with that charity to basically combat child poverty in Canada. Branch that out to other countries as well. Probably the US would be next, and then maybe other places from there. So basically these websites are searchable databases of companies who make products, like actually manufacture products in Canada, which is at the .ca site, and then also in the US, which is the .com version, of course. And so these companies actually make products in our respective countries, which I think is really important, because when we're actually making products locally, it's something that's really good for the local economy. It creates more jobs. It's also something that, in my opinion and to my understanding, is good for the environment, because we're not shipping things, from overseas or whatnot. And then it's also something that bolsters our entrepreneurs, our middle class. I think that I have concerns about the division of wealth that I believe, to my understanding, is just getting worse and worse. I'm planning to eventually have a podcast episode about that at some point. Lots of ideas for podcast episodes. And so I think that by trying to strengthen the middle class, you know, I'd much rather, you know, buy a product from a company that's making something, you know, here in Canada than, you know, another company that already has, you know, trillions of dollars, maybe not trillions, but, you know, millions or billions of dollars. And it's like, do they really need more money? And can I support a local company that, you know, definitely could use more money? So when it says made local, it's really, you know, more like made national, you know, made in Canada, made in the USA. That's where those sites are for. And eventually I plan to branch out to other countries as well, but it's only so many hours in the day. The last website URL here is optimisticfuturepodcast.com. So if you haven't checked it out already, please consider visiting the site. There's a list of simple steps that one can incorporate to help make the world a better place, to work on environmental or economic or societal challenges that we're having. I mean, I'm going to be a little hard pressed to find simple steps in this podcast episode because some of these things like attachment parenting, oh my gosh, that's not a simple step. And of course, you know, not something everyone would be interested in. But for other topics like, you know, not mowing your lawn in the month of May, you know, trying to avoid, you know, don't wear your shoes in the house to keep toxic chemicals down, don't wear perfume and cologne because they're toxic chemicals that are, don't mean to be too brutal here, but like poisoning you and everybody around you. And it costs money for them as well. So stop wearing them, save some money, save the planet, you know, save each other. So there's a list of different suggestions on there on that website. So anyways, I will leave it there. Thank you for your attention, and I hope that this was of interest.